This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Today's show comes from Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston, Idaho, where they celebrated Women's History Month with a number of presentations. I have two of them for you today. They're not presentations that are very related, except for that they relate to women. So we've got, they're quite a collection. The first one is called Winter's End. It comes to us from Sherry Calvert, who's an author of the book called The Garden Song, A True Story About Rape. She tells us that 1 in 6 American women and 1 in 33 American men are sexually assaulted in their lifetimes, and that 60%, however, of all sexual assaults are not reported, so those numbers could be quite a bit higher. Sherry Calvert herself was a victim, and the result was that she wrote her story, The Garden Song, A True Story of Rape. It speaks courageously of her descent into darkness and her emergence into the light. But you don't have to have your home invaded or your physical body attacked to experience the painful devastation that follows in the wake of damaged trust. So how do we begin to replant the seeds of hope and find joy and balance again in our lives? Sherry Calvert helps us to understand that.
From our gardens, like patience for one thing. A garden takes time, and you've got to love it. Coming down south here today, I saw my first daffodils peeking out from Winter Garden's awakening. Daffodils always just give me a happy heart. They seem to grow pretty easily multiply easily for me up in Coeur d'Alene. However, down in Mexico, gardeners tell me that daffodils are rare because they have to dig them up each year, refrigerate them for a while, and then replant them before they'll bloom. I think there are times here in the North Country when we all yearn for the eternal sunshine of a tropical paradise. However, sometimes it takes the shock of a cold winter to trigger new growth cycles. And sometimes it takes many long dark nights to prepare for the next season's flowers. My garden has taught me that just as the daffodils need the dark, cold time of dormancy, I too needed to allow myself to go down into the darkness before I could sprout new shoots of trust and blossom once again. It is the rhythm of nature. Page 148 of my book. I was moving through life with the white-knuckled intensity of driving down the freeway on black ice. If I shifted my focus from my immediate safety for one moment, I imagined I would go skidding out of control, crashing into another dangerous situation where there would be no escape. I had to remain vigilant. I had to protect myself. I felt as vulnerable as a baby bird pushed from its nest with a horde of alley cats waiting to pounce from the shadows. I imagined sadistic thoughts brewing behind the eyes of even my most trusted friends. I envisioned evil waiting in the darkness like those big Seattle slugs ready to devour the tender new shoots of trust that I tried to grow during those long gray days. I was suffering from constant fatigue. Fear cropped up for me around every corner with the increasing frequency of espresso stands in the Pacific Northwest. I moved forward with all of the enthusiasm of a robotic vacuum cleaner, circling aimlessly, bumping into things, backing up, and having some difficulty with mild obstacles and rough surfaces. Although I kept plugging ahead, it felt like I was on autopilot, and sometimes it took all of my energy to just go through the motions of my day. It felt like the gears to my internal engine had been stripped. I felt like a dying battery without enough energy left to turn over my starter motor. I stopped going to my evening weightlifting and yoga classes at the gym. I was afraid to cross the parking lot at night. I locked my car doors as soon as I got in. I was scared that someone might jump in and abduct me when I slowed for stop signs. I was terrified to go back into my home. I had my landline phone turned off and abandoned my home-based business. Just until they catch him, I told myself. But days turned into weeks, and weeks into months with no break in the case. Suppose they never catch him, I thought to myself. For the first time, I assimilated that notion as a very real possibility. You don't have to have your home invaded or your physical body attacked to experience the devastation that loss of trust can evoke. From disappointment in the integrity of a friend or coworker to the heart-wrenching pain of infidelity in a marriage, trust issues can tear us apart. How do we pick up the pieces and put them back together and start to rebuild when it is time? Page 17, inch by inch, row by row. I'd always loved those David Mallet lyrics. As the tune ran through my head, I leaned on my shovel handle on the corner of 15th Street and Coeur d'Alene Avenue, taking a break as I surveyed the expanse of mown weeds that passed for lawn on the property I'd just purchased. The tiny area of turned earth was minuscule in comparison, but I knew I was good at tedious long-term projects once I had a vision. With my artist's eye, I imagined red climbing roses covering an arbor, apple trees in bloom, a row of lush raspberries and a path of river rock winding through an edible landscape lavishly interspersed with flowering perennials and sweet-smelling herbs. A row of lilacs would follow 15th Street, edged with yellow irises. I would grow snap peas, spinach, tomatoes, green beans, and lots of varieties of squash. There would be lavender for making sachets, bergamot for attracting the hummingbirds, and fresh lemon thyme for seasoning salads. One day this will all be garden, I affirmed to myself, as I hacked out another few inches of knapweed, wild morning glory, and dandelion-infested turf. That day, back in 1995, now seems like a lifetime ago, on that high-profile corner, many had stopped to watch me garden and express their appreciation for the transformation resulting from my hard work and perseverance. as I turned my vision into a reality. It was time to start planting some new seeds now, to create a new garden. Yet now I lacked the clear vision I had back then. I wasn't sure just what I wanted to grow and what new tools I would need as I searched for a piece of fertile ground. Blocking out the unpleasantness of the jail waiting room, I allowed my memories to continue to carry me away like a yellow paper kite on a June breeze. I soared above in the expanse of blue sky. I was back in my garden, tending my yard. "Watch out for the a red-haired neighbor kid careened carelessly around the corner on a beat-up bicycle and caught my attention as I entered the garden through the rose arbor, garden trowel in hand. With my focus on the abundance of sweet-smelling pink blossoms overhead, I'd almost stepped in a steaming pile of dog lying smack in the middle of the trail. It looked to me like a pooch protest against the proprieties of living downtown. I leaned down and deftly flipped it off the trail into the rose bed with a little red trowel, nodded an appreciative thanks to the passing kid. Then I buried it with another trowel full of rich, dark earth, hoping that somewhere down the line, with time, it would decompose and would add nourishment to the blossoming of future roses. Everything I really need to know I've learned in my garden, I thought to myself. My garden always holds such wisdom when I take the time to listen. How can I transform all this that I've recently encountered on my life's path into something fragrant and beautiful? I wondered as the loudspeaker brought me back to the cinder block room, announcing that it was now time for the visits to begin. Life is full of beauty and unexpected piles of shit. I wish I could just bury the crap so I could continue smelling the sweet roses in my life, I thought to myself as the closed circuit TV monitor in front of me came to life. But sometimes it just becomes too much to bury. The label on the bottle of aspirin said pain reliever, but I got no relief from the painful images that looped endlessly in my memory. At that point, I could not control my mind and my thoughts, but I still had control over my body, and so that's where I started. I went back to the gym and I put one foot in front of the other until the sweat poured into my eyes, blending with the tears, and the endorphins danced in my brain. And I remembered to breathe deeply and open to grace. For me, physical exercise was important in releasing endorphins that allowed emotions to move. One woman told me that for her, running was not a sport, it was a religion. I was finding increasing joy in my yoga practice. Combining physical movement with spiritual prayer was helping me to move through my pain to a place of peace. It allowed me to go within and connect with something bigger than myself, something pure and good. And I discovered that what I practiced on the yoga mat was accompanying me as I stepped back out into the world. Page 109. I indulged myself with every available opportunity to happily putter away in my new gardens. I divided the irises and transplanted the sweet williams, giving away starts of yellow loosestrife and wild geraniums and a variety of succulents to anyone who would adopt them. I planted peas and beans and lettuce and Swiss chard and pumpkins and zucchini and summer squash. I set out the tomato and basil starts and squeezed in a row of cilantro. There was always something to attend to in a garden. And whenever I needed a break from the computer screen, a stroll through the yard inevitably rewarded me with some new discovery, a gift of the moment. No matter how many times I experience it, no matter how commonplace it may be to others, I am always amazed and in awe of the miracle of new life. From the tenacious sprouting of the winged maple seeds from the barren expanse of the patio concrete to the swellings of the first fruit on the squash vines, I celebrate new life. When I find a single white poppy amidst the thousands of orange-colored petals, I stop and worship its uniqueness. When I notice a daisy with two heads, I give it special attention and wish that society gave people the same honoring for their uniqueness that I feel towards my plants. I stop and pull a weed here and there, bending and twisting into my garden yoga poses as I assess the growth progress and mentally take inventory of what needs more attention. I do forward folds, triangles, and twists as I pull weeds and cultivate the soil. It is a time alone, a time of prayer and meditation, a time to open to grace and experience gratitude. The order and consistency of nature is comforting. I know without a doubt that day will follow night, and spring will always come again, even after the harshest of winters. I know that the garden of my soul needs all seasons. Each seed needs to go down into the darkness for a while before it sprouts new life, and it needs wind, rain, and sun to grow strong. I had descended into the darkness, weathered the winds of violent change, been washed clean with my tears, and was now ready to sprout new growth and blossom once again in the sun. Although I frequently returned to my office work with dirt underneath my fingernails, I was always more grounded. A fierce storm drives the rain against the south-facing window of my second-story office. The wind chimes complain loudly as the 50-plus mile-per-hour wind slams them into a newel post on the porch below. The prosecution had finally released my personal belongings that had been confiscated for evidence in November of 2003. I drove to the Coeur d'Alene police station to pick up a brown paper bag containing a watch, a necklace, a pair of socks, my favorite yoga pants, velour top, and leather shoes. My clothes were old. The jewelry was of little value. But it was a matter of closure, I explained to the officers. I signed the required forms for release of the items. After 4 years, I tentatively try on these garments and accessories, and as I do, I symbolically reclaim so many more important things that were taken from me that night. I take back my visions of beauty, my trust in goodness, and my courage in reaching out. I snuggle into the security of a warm and loving extended family that continues to support and inspire me. I step out onto the porch and look up at the gray skies and the brown, shriveled remains of the winter garden. Plant your rose straight and long, season with a prayer and song. Mother Earth will make you strong if you give her loving care. Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. It had been a rough winter, and although the landscape sometimes looked harsh and lifeless, I know there are many more flowers just awaiting their time to bloom in my healing garden. My personal garden song has not ended. Instead, I feel like it is just beginning But seeds or bulbs left in the darkness for too long risk rotting. A final step in healing comes through moving beyond our personal pain to a place of service, looking outward for places where we can plant new bulbs of hope for the next generation. Daffodils have meanings of faith, honesty, truth, forgiveness, and forthrightness. They are ever vigilant in returning each spring, and with their return we are reminded that their beauty is capable of following even the harshest of winters.
You can get Sherry Calvert's book, The Garden Song, a true story about rape, at thegardensong.com. That's the-garden-song.com.
It was down by the Sally Gardens, my love and I did meet. She passed the Sally Gardens with little snow-white feet. She bid me take love easy as the leaves grow up on the tree. But I was young and foolish and with her did not agree. In a field down by the river, my love and I did stand. And on my leaning shoulder, she laid her snow-white hand. She bid me take life easy as the grass grows on the weeds. But I was young and foolish, and now am full of
installment number two is A Different View from Behind the Veil. This comes from Diana Ames. She is a lecturer in anthropology at Lewis Clark State College. She talks about the different meanings of purdah and veiling in the Islamic world today. This is, of course, an important topic to us in the West as we interact more and more with Muslim cultures and they become part of our culture. And as we interact in the Middle East, Diana Ames starts off by giving us a list of some of the different names of veils or modest dress, especially in the Middle Eastern cultures.
Perhaps the ones that we're most familiar with these days, we hear people talking about the burqa, And my Arabic and Pashto are pretty pathetic, so you will hear that word pronounced burqa, you will hear it burqa. But this is a term that you typically find in Afghanistan for Afghani women and the particular veiling that is used there. You'll hear the term hijab used, and this is a term that is used generally for all kinds of coverings of women. Milaya is a term you'll hear used in among Egyptian women. The abaya, a term that you'll often hear in Iraq. Chador is one you'll hear a reference to particularly Iranian women. The jellaba or the haika in North Africa. And then finally, you may have heard the term yashmak, which is a Turkish term. So what you're looking at there are different languages, different forms of veiling, different forms of covering for women, but all of them connected to somehow to this idea that it is essential for a righteous and honorable Islamic woman in the Middle East to be veiled or covered in some particular way. So I want to stop right there and say that, in fact, that's not the case. If we look historically going back in the Middle East 60 or 80 years, what we'll see is, depending on the society, there has been a tremendous variation. In fact, back in the right after World War I, in the late teens and early 1920s, one of the biggest symbols of independence in the Middle East and for Egyptian women was a number of Egyptian feminists who publicly removed their veils and were photographed and were leaders of the feminist movement, all of which was tied into the independence movements in which, at that time, men and women, Egyptian men and women, were trying to gain independence from Great Britain. And this continued well into the 50s and 60s. In Egypt, for instance, there's a long tradition of Islamic women who have worn what we would consider to be traditional Western dress as opposed to traditional Islamic dress. And this has occurred in a variety of places as well. The same thing, independence, political independence, break from the West, often used women's symbols and used the symbols of veiling as a means to, as a political means to express their break from whatever Western influence there was or imperial kind of influence there was, the French, the British, whomever. So one of the things that we need to understand is that there is no uniformity. And in fact, even if we go back to the beginnings of Islam in the 7th century AD, we'll find that right in the Arabic, in the Arabian Peninsula where it originated, where Islam originated, that at first it was not a uniform requirement. If you read the Quran, and you read which is the sacred text of Islam, and it's very, very explicit. It sets forth the behaviors and values that are expected of righteous Muslim individuals, male and female. The requirement for veiling or dress or whatever simply is a simple, very simple statement that a righteous woman essentially will be a woman who brings herself close to God, brings herself close to Allah, by dressing modestly. And it simply refers to modest dress. It does not talk about veils. It does not talk about chadors or abayas or any other specific garment, but simply talks about the idea that a woman is expected to dress modestly. And at first, in the beginnings of Islam, the only women who veiled were the prophet's wives, that is, Muhammad's wives. And even they didn't do that until very near the end of his life. So then the question becomes is, how did this association of veiling and dress become so powerfully connected to our idea about what it means to be an Islamic woman in the Middle East? And likewise, how have we associated that and how have we begun to use that in our own ideas in dealing with the Middle East, and what has often happened is, or what has happened most recently, And by that I mean in the last 20 years or so, 20 or now almost 30 years or so, is that we have taken on this notion of Islamic dress for women as being a symbol of oppression. And that certainly is the case in the most common instance of our being the United States interaction, and that would be with the Iranian Revolution. And as many of you know, the Iranian Revolution was a religious revolution. It was a religious and cultural revolution in 1978, led by the Ayatollah Khomeini, whose goal it was to restore an original, what he termed a kind of original Islam, go back to the original Islam. There are a lot of problems with that, and actually what he was really talking about was a political goal of detaching himself from the Shah's government and from the Shah's association with Western nations and Western governments. And one of the ways that he sought to do this was to command and demand that women return to modest Islamic dress, to wearing the chador and to covering. Also to removing women from the public sphere to a much greater extent. And the extent to which they were in the public sphere was now much more limited. So women now much more, at that time, were much more restricted in being able to go to the university, being able to be out in public, being able to work outside the home, things like that. We see an even more severe expression of this kind of using women as a means to, as a political instrument, if you will, among the Taliban in Afghanistan. And this goes back to the period when the Soviets were invading Afghanistan. So again, this goes back 30 years or so. We now happen to be the Western outsiders in Afghanistan, and the Taliban are, again, an extremely fundamentalist political sect of Muslims in Afghanistan. Again, one of the powerful symbols of this is using women in all kinds of ways, and in particularly restricting their ability to go out in public, but full covering, and the burqa and gloves, and, you know, not just veiling, not just a cloak, but full face covering, covering of the hands, covering of the arms, that no flesh is to be seen. And if a woman is out in public, she must be completely covered this way, and she must be accompanied by a related male, or husband, or father, or brother, someone like that. And to do otherwise brings dishonor on her and on the family, and ultimately, in the very extreme among the Taliban, would be seen as justification for an honor killing if this woman were to in any way violate these kinds of strictures. What I'd like to do is just briefly talk a little bit about some of the meanings that the veil does have. And when I use the veil here, I'm using generally a term that may mean any kind of head covering. It might mean a face veil, it might not. Certainly something covering the hair and coming down over the shoulders in some way, usually covering the neck as well. And then possibly it may involve some kind of a long garment, usually long-sleeved or long garment, which might be a cloak of some kind, or it could simply be a long dress with long sleeves as well. And the video that I'm going to show you looks at some women and a movement in Egypt among Egyptian women, among Islamic Egyptian women, to return to the veil, to return, and these are women who are often very well educated, engineers, professors, doctors, clerks, secretaries, things like this, but women who are working out in public, but who choose to use the veiling and the modest Islamic dress as a means of expression of their faith. So I think that's the most important place to start. Is there is this Western notion that veiling and covering is uniformly something akin to what the Taliban have done, or what Khomeini and others in Iran have done in terms of oppressing women. And there's no question that it does. I mean, there's simply no question that those movements and those groups have sought to use the clothing and the veiling and to oppress women and to move women out of the public sphere, move them out of any kind of work outside of the home, to change the dynamics and structure of society and of family very, very dramatically. And the West has taken that as being, Westerners in general, have taken that extreme as and associated it with any kind of covering or veiling. What I'd like to talk about are a couple of studies that look at what the meaning of modest Islamic dress and veiling and covering is for women in general. There was a study done, and it's a really interesting one, that looks at the relationship between veiling and women's association and women's meanings about veiling for among Palestinian women during the Intifada. And the Intifada was an uprising of Palestinians against in the various Palestinian territories, Gaza Strip and other areas of Palestinian refugee areas. In 1984, the study shows that about 11% of Palestinian women wore the hijab, any kind of veiling or head covering. By 93, there was about 50% of women were wearing it, and the breakdown of that was younger women, 15 to age 19, about 44% of them were wearing it. Women 20 to 29, about 50% of them were wearing it, and women 30 to 39, about 53% of them were now wearing it. So what accounts for this during this period? I mean, the variable here, the big variable was this uprising and this tremendous social uprising during this period. And yet what Pulsed saw was women seemingly returning to this modest Islamic dress, and it surprised a number of people. The study was done to assess what the meanings of this was for women and the reasons for the increase in this. And the reasons that these women gave for this were, first and foremost, expression of faith for women to bring them closer to Allah. That for religious women, for women whose faith is tremendously important to them, and as it was among these Palestinian women, they wanted to express their devotion to God, and in expressing their devotion to God, this was one of the ways they felt they could do it, was to return to this sort of modest dress. Another one was protection from harassment. There was a perception anyway that women who were wearing this dress were less likely to be harassed within their own society or from outsiders, from Israeli peacekeepers or anyone, Israelis in the community. The next reason was an expression of political power and authority, asserting themselves in terms of solidarity, political solidarity with this movement, with the Intifada, that this is something that women can do, and in putting on this dress, they are aligning themselves with that political movement. Feeling of belonging as a cultural symbol, sort of unity, bringing together the society. Yes, we are here in this refugee camp. There's a fourth generation of men and women living and growing up in this community, in this refugee community. And this is an expression of our cultural solidarity as well as our faith solidarity. And then they talked about things such as modesty, chastity, and faith for both men and women. It became an important kind of issue for them. Another study that I found, I thought it was an interesting one because it deals much more with what we around here might see in terms of Islam. And these are Muslim women in Canada, where they are the minority, as opposed to the majority in Palestine. But in Canada, and this was in Winnipeg, this was a study done in Winnipeg, that dealt with Islamic gender ideology in Canada and looked again at what is the role of dress, of women's dress, of traditional Islamic dress. this was done as a kind of ethnographic study with some interviewing and living in the community. There was an increase in veiling, and this study was done in 2004. The focus was on the increase in veiling among women. And so again, trying to look at correlations here, what's going on, what are the cultural meanings behind this increase in Canadian veiling. The increase was particularly in the public sphere, obviously, otherwise people wouldn't have noticed it. Individuals said first and foremost with family, the solidarity of the family, that women saw themselves, this dress as a way by which they could remain active in the public sphere and at the same time maintain their honorable family status and the honor of the family. Again, protection from unwanted harassment, either political harassment, individuals who might be anti-Muslim, or from any kind of sexual harassment. An expression of faith, and one of the women says that she used her dress, her modest Islamic dress, as a physical reminder of her priorities to Allah. And she said that it was essential for her to keep in mind all the time that her goal was to bring herself to a state of grace with Allah, and that this was one way that she could do this, that dress really helped her. An expression of spiritual beauty versus Western ideal of physical beauty. And many of the women commented on this, which was the idea that in the West, the focus is so much on the physical ideal of beauty, you know, the classic sort of Western model, the extreme, you know, being very, very thin, all of the kinds of things that we're aware of when we talk about beauty in our society, and some of the issues that leads to, including eating disorders of various kinds. What many of these women said was that in putting on the veil and putting on whatever coverings, whatever modest coverings they were doing it as Muslim to bring themselves back, to remind them about spiritual beauty, and to get back into this mode of thinking about spiritual beauty as opposed to physical beauty in this sort of Western ideal. One of the women who had been bulimic said that she hadn't intended this, but when she returned to wearing the veil, it relieved her of that pressure to this sort of extreme ideal of Western ideal of beauty, and that, in fact, her bulimia virtually disappeared at that point. That it gave them the freedom to move around again by, they can be active out in the public sphere without diminishing their personal honor or the honor of their family. A cultural identity as well that was critically important to them. So when we look at what's going on in terms of veiling, one of the things that I think we have to remember is that it's very specific from society to society, and therefore from cultural value, from sets of cultural values to different sets of cultural values. The modest dress of a woman in Iran is different from that of Iraq, is different from that of Turkey, is different from that in Afghanistan, is different from that of a woman in Saudi Arabia. What we have to do then is to look at both the cultural and spiritual history in that community. What was there before Islam? How did people dress? How did women dress? What was the sense of male and female relationships there in those cultural contexts? And then look likewise at how has Islam developed in that society? What we'll see is that Islam looks different in each of these societies. It's not as uniform as we all imagine it is. At least as we imagine it is from the Western media. One of the studies that has been done on early Islam shows that, again, it was only the prophets' wives who were veiled, and that in general Islam was, you know, modest dress did not include this kind of heavy-duty veiling until Islam spread out into the Byzantine and Persian empires and spread out, came in contact with Christian, early Christian, and Judaic societies where that stricture was much more powerful for women to veil, and then if we look at Christianity, you know, we see this very strong, the seclusion of women, that purdah was a very powerful part. What do you do with unmarried women in early medieval Christianity? You take them to a convent. It's a very extreme example of it, but veiling and coverings of all kinds look exactly like the most extreme thing we'll see here today. And of course, in Christianity, head covering was required for a woman to go into church. There's only a few of us in here who remember, but you didn't go into church without your head being covered and often veiled as well until, I don't know, post-Vatican II? And even then, you know, I can remember after that, I still, you know, I was a teenager, but my mother still made me wear a hat to church. I mean, you just didn't get away without going into church without a hat. And that was, you know, a remnant left over from this idea. And you know, if you look in the whole circum-Mediterranean region, this notion of purdah is very powerful in southern Italy, in Greece, in Spain, Portugal, North Africa. But, you know, if you look at southern Europe, you see very much the same symbols, veiling, covering, dark covers. And there's also the virginity test. I don't know how many of you are aware of the virginity test, but this is a test to, you know, is a woman a virgin? Is there blood on the wedding sheet signifying her virginity? And the first time I encountered this notion was seeing a picture in Life magazine when I was probably about 12 or 13. And it was a picture in southern Italy of a woman, old woman, hanging the bedsheet of her daughter or granddaughter out the window, hanging it out with the bloody bedsheet to signify that this is an honorable family, that my daughter or granddaughter was a virgin. Now, we hear something like that, and we're going, oh, my God, this is just so oppressive. And you often hear this now relative to Islam, but it you know, this was happening in Christianity long and Judaism long before it was happening elsewhere. Now, what happens if this poor unfortunate virgin didn't bleed? Because, of course, that does happen, and she was a virgin, and there was no question about it. Well, mom and mother-in-law standing by with probably a little chicken blood or lamb's blood or something, because, after all, you know, she's a perfectly honorable girl. But this is an extreme version of this idea of family honor and how the honor of the woman affects the honor of the family, which is often used as an excuse for, or often used as a justification for why and how it is that women are dressed the way they do and dressed out in public and moving around in public. But this existed in Judaism and still does. If you look at Orthodox Judaism, covering of the head of Orthodox women. Head covering is something you find in Hinduism. Purdah actually is a word that comes out of Hindi. It's a Sanskritic word and comes out of Hindi. And this has been going on in societies around the world, in religious traditions for time immemorial. So we have to be careful of not projecting our current ideas about feminism in our own society on other cultural groups. What I'm saying is that dress has been used as a means of controlling women to a great extent, and the control is in, should these women be out in the public sphere or should they be in the domestic sphere? And to a great extent, you can argue, in fact, how much control do they have in the domestic sphere, which is often very significant. I didn't mean to imply that it's okay to, you know, justify it that way. It's not. But it is a fact, it's an historic fact, that this has been going on long before Islam. What I was trying to say was that the media today, that our media today tends to use contemporary Muslim dress for women as a sort of a priori assumption that these women are oppressed. And what I'm saying is that the meanings of that Islamic dress today are very varied, and with the exception of the notable exception of the Taliban and the Iranian examples, that there are lots of other meanings going on here about it, that women in fact have control over a certain amount of that.
That was Diana Ames. She's on the anthropology faculty at Lewis Clark State College. Her talk was called A Different View from Behind the Veil. This Yin Radio show comes to you from Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston, Idaho, where we recorded presentations that were made as part of Women's History Month. It was a 7-part series organized by Dr. Amy Canfield last March 2010. We're going to wrap up our Yin Radio show with more music. It is from the band Curious. These are 3 men and 3 women who make up this German wave band. The song is called Behind the Veil. Catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive updates about the program or make a contribution to support Yin Radio. Please do drop us a line anytime you'd like. You can do that at yinradio at vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Thanks so much for joining me. Until next week.